Welcome to the 19th episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm Luke DeCock. With me, as always, John Clockerty. And John, not specifically a college basketball issue, but let's jump right into the NFL games, the AFC and NFC championships that were played just this weekend. And really, there were a lot of issues raised officiating-wise from those games. The no-call on the pass interference in the Saints-Rams game, several controversial calls in the Chiefs-Patriots game, that video reviews that I thought one was inconclusive, and things like that. But the main thing that came out of that is the NFL appears to be considering, or at least thinking about, allowing video review of judgment calls, like that blown pass interference call in the Rams-Saints game. What were your thoughts, first of all, John, watching that as a former official and father of a football official, and two, on the general process of where we are with replay and judgment calls and all of that?
Yeah, I saw both games, and if I had been a fan of Kansas City, or if I'd been a fan of New Orleans, and I am a fan of the Steelers, I would, I'd be up in arms and upset. But the reality and the truth is, those calls have been one of the calls was very egregious, and it's hard to understand how it could have been missed, but it was missed, and I think the explanation from the official later on says he thought that the player and the ball had gotten there at the same time. It was not just one official that could have made the call. There was a secondary official that could have jumped in there and made the call. But Luke, to answer your question, I saw those plays, and I sit there and I say to myself, how can they miss them? But they do miss them. And I was especially thought, when you see a play, you have to be absolutely sure if you're going to throw the flag. Or I've always told my officials, if we just get the obvious, and this is when I was a supervisor, if we just get the obvious plays that everybody could see, that there's no question about, I can deal with the 50-50 plays, whether it's with the coaches or that's involved in the game. 50-50 plays or marginal judgment calls, I can deal with. The very obvious ones were always gave you angst as a supervisor. But I think if you start, and this is what I've been reading the last two or three days, that they're going to go back, the competition committee and the rules, they're going to look at rules that may be expanding the replay to look at judgment calls. Luke, I could not be more against something like that, because you are, in my opinion, you are getting involved in so many judgment calls throughout the game. If you're dealing with a clock issue and you want to get that right, or if you're dealing with whether a guy's knee was down before the ball came out, you want to see if the ball came out or the knee came down on a touchdown and things of that sort. That all makes sense to me. But when you start talking about judgment calls, there is multiple situations that I can envision that you're going to have to start going back looking at replay. And that the games are long enough. Now you're getting, I don't know how many challenges they'll have, or they're going to do this in the last minute or two. There was a play in which a defensive lineman reached across the offensive blocker and hit Brady in the chest area and not in the helmet. And he got a penalty for that that extended the New England's drive. Are you going to go back? I didn't like the call. The call was incorrect.
Right.
The guy did not hit Brady in the helmet.
Right. And the referee who made the call was blocked out by Brady's head. So he saw the arm go down, but he never actually saw the arm hit the head. Isn't that the old rule? Call what you see,
call
not what you
see.
Think you see.
Call the obvious. Call what you see. If you're not sure, don't call it. And now you're going to go back and look at that and take that penalty back? That was a judgment call by that referee. It was on the wrong side of the judgment, but it was wrong.
Right.
So I just can't go down that road and say, even regardless of the consequences and who's going to go to the Super Bowl and who's not, you can't start looking at judgment calls, because now you're going to look at a whole bunch of situations where you can put a finger on, well, that was not right. That the judgment was not right on that, and you just tie yourself up in those situations.
And we have enough trouble in football figuring out what is and isn't a catch going frame by frame. There was the Chris Hogan play, which was ruled a catch. I think I would have gone with inconclusive on that one. I couldn't tell. It looked like the ball may have had control, may not have. It was ruled a catch on the field. I was fine with the idea of that replay being inconclusive. Same with the punt that Julian Edelman didn't touch, as it turns out. I would have been fine if they'd called that replay inconclusive and gave the Chiefs the ball, because I don't know that you could tell conclusively he didn't touch the ball.
Luke, exactly. And I was going to say exactly the point you made. You know, they ruled on the field that he had touched it, and Kansas City recovered and gone for a touchdown. Was there enough evidence to overturn that? I tell you, that was a close one. And, they had enough angles, which in those games you're going to have a ton of cameras that gives you good angles, but they're seeing something. They've already ruled that it was a touchdown, and now they're coming back and say it was absolutely inconclusive or conclusive. It means absolute. He didn't touch it. Well, I don't know if that was absolute or not.
Yeah. I didn't think he touched it watching the replay. I did not think he touched it watching you put. I would not swear my life on that. And that's supposed to be the standard, the drunk in the bar standard, right?
Exactly.
The guy, even the drunk in the bar can see it.
I think you're right.
So we have this many issues with catches and things like that. Now they want to talk about pass interference. Can you imagine rocking back and forth frame by frame, looking at did the ball or his hand get there first? That to me, like, we're losing. I mean, you know how much I hate instant replay to begin with, but to me, we're losing. You wanna over adjudicate every single play frame by frame, then get the officials off the field. Have each official be watching a monitor, and they get 10 seconds after each play to review their area of the field or their camera replays and call whatever penalties they see on replay. We might as well do that, you know, and have them call the entire game through a monitor.
Luke, we're on the same path on this, because
Clark Kellogg.
I don't. You know, being a Steeler fan, I'm telling you, in the New Orleans game. Now, New Orleans raising hell about they're not going to the Super Bowl because they get a terrible call, which I agree, a terrible call. But trust me, I am telling you, in the Steeler New Orleans game, they're down to a fourth possession, and they call Hayden for a Steeler defensive back that was clearly not pass interference, and or the Steelers beat New Orleans and the Steelers get a chance to go to the playoffs. Now, is that, Luke, I'm asking you, is that any different? Are you going to go back and review Hayden's interference call? I mean, these are the situations that are going to transpire throughout the whole season that are important. And I just can't see it happening. You can't get into judgment calls reviewing. And again, the game's long enough. You will be there for an entire afternoon if you start looking at the judgment calls.
All right, let me play devil's advocate. My feelings about replay are well known. However, isn't when college basketball officials, when they go to the monitor to look for a flagrant or assess a flagrant, isn't that a judgment call?
No, I don't believe that is the same situation. What they can't do is if they've called a foul, okay, a common foul, they can't go to the monitor and take that foul back, regardless of
right.
They cannot take a common foul back. But if they've called a foul, and they, for some reason, they have a suspicion that something was greater than the common foul that reaches the level of either a flagrant one or a flagrant two, then they can upgrade it. But that I don't think that's the same situation.
Anything else you want to add on replay? I feel like we spend a lot of our time talking about replay.
No, I think it's worth discussion because, you know, there was two really important games, and teams fight the whole season, every play, every game, to try to get to that level. And clearly it comes down to a pass interference call or, you know, if they rule that Edelman had touched that ball, Kansas City's going to the Super Bowl. You know, so it is important. And I know your feelings about replay, and I think replay in basketball and replay in football, where it is now, has great value. But I ask you this one more time: if you take that and say, okay, we're going to look at PIs as a process of replay. Tell me what's next. What's the next one?
Let's dial it back. I feel like in sports we live with players' errors. We need to go back to living with officials' errors. It's human. It's part of the game. I think we've established at this point, despite Tim Donaghy, that there's no malice or forethought involved in this. Officials screw up calls the same as players screw up plays. Let's live on. Let's deal with it and move on. Now, that said, the back judge or side judge or whoever whose area of responsibility it was on that pass interference call in the Saints game, what's it like that night or the next morning when you know you've blown that call?
Well, look, I hate to interject my own experience, but that guy...
That's why you're here.
Well, that guy that didn't make the call is suffering because... He does not want to, not only his reputation is being damaged. The whole situation came down to one play, and he was involved in it. And he that's the last thing he wants on his shoulders. But he's an NFL referee. He's got to make those decisions. And even though I'm a referee at heart, I believe, even though it's a judgment call, I believe there's consequences to both of them that didn't make that.
Sure.
Okay. They have to be accountable too.
And these are guys working a championship game who graded out among the best over the course of the season.
That's why they're there, because they had great seasons. But they have to be accountable also. But going back, you know, I had an experience in '89 where I made a call in overtime, a judgment call that. If you looked at that on replay and you're a Seton Hall fan, you say, that is the sorriest call I've ever seen. And if you're a Michigan guy, and you say, you know, there's plenty enough contact. But I had a sleepless night, and I had a sleepless week. And these officials are going to have a tough off season. And I don't know what, if anything, that the NFL will do, but they're going to be accountable, I believe.
Congrats, everybody. That was center square on the whistleblower's bingo card. John mentioning Michigan Seton Hall. Mark that down on your cards. Let's get back to basketball on that note. Incident in the Tulsa-UConn game where both coaches were ejected. How often does that? That can't happen very often.
It doesn't. I can't remember. I truly can't remember when it happened.
At least simultaneously.
Right. Well, you know, I think back when Rick Barnes was at Clemson, Rick Barnes and Coach Smith got to yelling at each other up at the scorers table, and they may have been assessed technicals. I'm not sure. It's been such a while, Luke. I'm not sure. But they got to in each other's face, and they got them separated, and the game went on. But, you know, I'm going to say this because I can. I've dealt with Hurley.
Well, let's backtrack and say what happened before you start slaughtering people.
Yeah.
So this is the UConn-Tulsa game. There was a sort of similar thing to Smith and Barnes at the scorer's table with Frank Haith and Danny Hurley yelling at each other. Got pretty heated. They were both assessed technical fouls. And then it kind of went on. And later, Haith and Hurley would both say they were trying to get together and shake hands. That was their claim. But Pat Adams, who was the official kind of keeping them apart, had enough of them at that point, hit them both, whacked them both with another tee, and they got thrown out. After the game, both Haith and Hurley were extremely unhappy about the sequence of events. So that's where we were before I cut you off there. So
No, I'm glad you cut me off.
But I will tell you this.
Pat Adams is an experienced referee, a referee that's been to the Final Four. He has credibility. If those two coaches had gone back to their teams and back to their huddles after they had been assessed a technical foul, if they would have separated and gone back, Pat, there would have never been an ejection with either one. Let's not put this on the referee as the league did and as the two coaches did. This goes on both those coaches. They could have walked away, and I don't care if Hurley's saying, I'm coming down there to shake his hand, and Frank Hayes said, no, we were just going to meet there and pass pleasantries. That's a bunch of BS. If they go back to their huddles, you tell me, Luke, if they walk away and say, okay, I'm done, and I go back to my huddle, do you think they get ejected? Absolutely not. Pat Adams got too much experience and too much moxie to throw them out unless if they would have done what they were told to do and to get back and coaching their team and quit this mess up at the scorer's table. I have no understanding on those guys. I saw what was highlights later what was going on, and I don't think Pat Adams acted out of line on that.
How would you describe your experiences with those two coaches as a supervisor?
Well, Bobby Hurley, when I was supervising the Danny Hurley.
This is Danny Hurley.
I apologize, Bobby.
loyal listener Bobby Hurley jumps out of his chair.
Danny Hurley was for my referees, and even for me, was tough to deal with, okay? And when I had Frank Haith was at Miami, he also was a chronic complainer about officials. Every time he lost, most every time he lost, I expected a phone call from him complaining about referees and also Danny Hurley.
How unusual is that?
That is a very unusual.
Okay, so not every coach is doing it.
Oh, no. If our listeners think that coaches call and complain all the time, that's not true. I mean, there are coaches that I have never heard. I was a supervisor for 11 years, and I have never heard from a number of our coaches. Leonard Hamilton had some tough wins and good wins and some tough losses in 11 years. I never heard from Leonard Hamilton. He never complained about officiating. But getting back to that situation, I just think, I read what the league said, that maybe Pat Adams and the crew overreacted. I'm not buying that.
You have very little sympathy for the coaches involved here.
Yeah. I have some personal experiences with them, I don't have much sympathy at all.
Should there be a standard for throwing coaches out of a game? Should there have to? I mean, should verbal? Like, obviously, if you get a warrant, you get a technical, you're on thin ice.
Yeah. And you don't have to. I mean, you can get thrown out on the first technical.
Sure.
And if you do the wrong thing, you may get thrown out. And actually, I think when Coach Boeheim took his coat off.
Oh yes, he did.
And he got thrown out by. He never received a second technical. Mm-hmm. That was
an easy one though.
That was easy.
By the time he hit center court, it was pretty clear that he was done for the night.
Yeah,
not that there was any game left.
He was, but. Yeah, I think there is a standard, and I think experienced officials know and have already gone to the coach and let them know that you said thin ice, and that's a good – that you're treading on thin ice, coach. You know, you've already got a technical. You need to get off officiating, coach your team. Whatever an experienced official wants to say to a coach – officials handle different ways. Sometimes they just roll their eyes and a coach gets the message. But Luke, I've said this before, coaches or officials will can tolerate and listen to a lot of stuff, maybe 9 yards, but sometimes the 10th yard it's too much.
Sure.
You know, and once they start making it personal, that was my standard. You can tell me about a lot of things, but when you start saying you're calling on us differently than you're calling it on them, now he's insinuating that you're taking care of them and penalizing us, and that now you're making it kind of personal.
What about when a coach wants to get thrown out?
And there's been there's been rare occasions, and he may even tell you, "I need to, I'm going to get fired up, and I'm going to come at you. I'm doing it for a purpose." It's very, very rare, but it has happened, and you accommodate him if he's going to tell you that. you say this is the coach. That's fine.
This is the easiest. Just bam.
Yeah,
and you,
that's not a hard one.
That's fine. Do you ever remember any instances of
that? I can't remember exactly, no. But I've had referees tell me, either as a supervisor or maybe it was even sitting around having a drink, that the coach told me he wanted to get tossed. His team was playing bad and the score was out of line and he needed to get the heck out of there. So he told me he wanted to get tossed and we tossed him.
How does that conversation go? Because everyone can see you guys talking.
Yeah, well, he says, I better not say. I thought one time maybe, I can't remember the exact. John Thompson was at DePaul, and I was in the game, and he was so upset, not at the crew, but at one official. And he told me after he got hit with the first technical, he says, "John, I'm getting tossed. Just so you know, but before I get tossed, I'm getting that referee. I'm going to get my piece on that referee." That's true. And he got teed up, and he never got a second one. I went after him pretty hard. I says, "Coach, you can't come out on the floor after this guy. I'm going to have to toss you." He said, "No, John, no, you're going to toss me. There's no problem with that. You're tossing me, but before you do, I'm going to get myself a piece of this guy." And I can remember that.
My favorite John Thompson story, we were in Columbus in 2012, and NC State was playing Georgetown, and John Thompson III was coaching Georgetown then, and Big John was doing national radio. So they had the media interview podium set up, and there was a holding area with the curtain off to the side, as usually happens. And someone asked John Thompson III about the traveling call in the NC State Georgetown game, the Rick Hartzell call, Corciani. And John Thompson III said, "I was pretty young then, but I thought it was a good call. I thought they got it right. I thought it was a good call." And this booming voice from the background on the other side of the curtain goes, "And it still is." He couldn't hold back.
No. Can I let me share one with you. A few years ago, I'm supervising, and there's a regional in Raleigh. And John is working for Westwood.
Westwood One, national
radio. Westwood One. So we're back in the locker room area, and he's coming down the hall, and I'm coming down the hall, and it had been years since I had seen John up close, and of course I had had a lot of his games when he was in the Big East, and so I walk up, I says, "John, Coach John Clockerty," says, "I'll never forget you. You screwed up so many of my games. How could I ever forget you?" And I laughed, and he did, and he just kept walking.
Yeah, going. When I, after that thing in Columbus, I wanted to ask him about it. I asked Big John about it in the hallway. So I ran out and caught him as he was leaving. And I asked him something about it. He looked at me, down at me, paused, and said, "Now you sound like one of those Princeton people." And I said, "Actually, John, I went to Penn. I thought that was a great call." And he kind of did a double take, and then he kind of chuckled, that deep chuckle, and turned and walked away.
I just says he said you screwed up so many of my games, but he actually didn't use the word screwed.
Yeah, I'm sure. he didn't use that word with me. He didn't use. You sound like one of those Princeton people.
Yeah.
A true character. And those DePaul Georgetown games, I grew up. That was the big game of the year in Chicago growing up. I mean, that was the big deal. That was the game.
DePaul was
the Rosemont Horizon.
One time. Who was the great coach? Myers?
Ray Meyer, and then his son Joey was there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Closer to home, Mike Eads of the ACC left Saturday's Virginia Tech-Wake Forest game 2 minutes in, which you don't obviously see very often. Turns out he has a knee injury that's going to need surgery, and he's going to miss 3 to 4 weeks, it looks like. Obviously a blow for the ACC since he would have had some big games assigned in that time period. And you never know when a guy gets hurt, if what the time frame is going to be. Could be less, could be more. But for Brian Kersey now, how hard is that to scramble to replace a guy that you rely on that heavily in the middle of January?
Replacing Mike Eads, because he is probably one of ACC's very best. That it's hard to replace. If you take a Mickey Mantle out of the lineup, it's hard to replace a guy like that. But Brian Kersey can take the other elite guys that he has, and maybe Roger Ayers will pick up two games, and he can use a Doug Schultz that I saw last night, or James Breeding, and fill Mike Eads' spots in. Saturdays could be really hard because a lot of teams are playing Saturday, so it'll be tough. My first thought what Brian can't have happen is the next guy go down.
Your bench is pretty thin.
Yeah,
at this
he can fill. Now, what will happen is, and this happened to me, a guy like a Roger Ayers or a Ron Gruber might end up seeing a team one or two more times that you would hope he didn't have to see. But with Eads coming out for 4 weeks or 3 weeks, Ron Gruber, Ali Cassell, or Roger Ayers, a Teddy Valentine, they'll fill in those spots and he'll be okay. But you're just holding your breath and hope that the next guy that has a full schedule doesn't go down. Now you are struggling. I lost Les Jones maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I lost Les Jones to a hip injury, and then I think I lost somebody else, and I thought, okay, now this is going to be very difficult. But we found out that guys were seeing teams too many times.
Yeah.
But we got through it.
I thought the crew, you mentioned Doug Shaw, it was last night we're recording this on a Tuesday, in Chapel Hill for UNC Virginia Tech. Doug Shouse, John Higgins, and Terry Weimer. That feels like the East Regional Final, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They're not guys who work a ton of...
They're all... Every single one of them have been to the Final Four. I don't know if one of them... or if all three were assigned the game originally, or one of them was called in to replace Mike Gage.
Yeah, and it's a Monday, so it's conceivable guys would have the night off.
Very much so. Yeah, absolutely.
I thought that crew was interesting. I can't remember who was on the crew in Raleigh for the UNC-NC State game, but it was Doug Sermons and two other big-time refs, all Final Four guys. That's another crew where a big conference game, ACC game, that kind of brought in some guys from outside. You know, as you said, you don't want these guys seeing the same teams too many times, so you have big games like that.
Was Doug Sermons in that game?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to remember Carolina State? Yeah, I'm trying to remember who the other two were. They were all Final Four guys.
I don't remember.
Not the top of my head, can't remember. But interesting as you know, trying to bring in some really good guys from other leagues and
Oh, and let them have I think Brian's doing a really good job. He went out when he first took the job. I guess this will be the third year that he's supervisor. I wasn't using
Kissinger was one of the other ones.
Don Daly.
So
that's a good crew.
That felt like the West Regional final.
Yeah, that's those guys. And that's my point. I think Brian has done a really good job of that. He relieves, gives his primary guys that you see a lot. They get some relief. They may be working on the other end of that,
Big East.
They're working possibly in the Big Ten, or I think Don Daly or Kip Kissinger may be Big Ten guys. I'm not quite sure, but Brian's done a good job of bringing good guys in for two or three, four games, and then he did a nice job of going out and Ron Groover and Lee Cassell and not Pat Adams, but Bert Smith, and he's got good guys and a lot of fresh faces.
We've talked a lot about the alliance on here, Big East, ACC, and these lower leagues, and how guys can move around, and you can kind of move young referees up as they're improving and getting better. We had a reader question about this. If you're not in the alliance, if you haven't gotten even to the sort of colonial Ivy League MEAC level yet, how do you make the jump from D2, JUCO, D3 games and get to that level? I know a lot of it has to do with camps and looking good at camps, but what is what advice would you give to an official who's working D3 games, who's working junior college games, who wants to get a look at that entry level in the alliance? What's the way in?
I think that's an excellent question, and I think it's hard. If you're working NAIA, D2, D3, how do you get to the next level? If I was a supervisor I'll give you, Johnny Kell came to me. Johnny Kell is the supervisor of the Big East, and I trust Johnny Kell's judgment wholeheartedly. And he would not recommend somebody, but he came to me on a couple different occasions, and he said, John, if you have room on your colonial staff, you need to get this guy on your roster because he's working upstate New York. He's working Division II, Division III upstate New York. I've put eyes on him. And if I had a secondary league, this would be Johnny Kell. If I had a secondary league, he says, but give him some colonial games because I trust John Kell. Or there might be Joe Forte that has a league that's, and he may recommend somebody. It would be hard. I've had camps and guys that worked our camps. One of the things that when I was running the camp, you had to be in a D2 or D3 league, or you weren't coming to our camp. But just like you're not big on replay. I was never big on camp because they're too cosmetic, and I had made some mistakes where I thought, well, this guy, I mean, he passes the eye test.
Looks like a ref,
runs like a ref, but then he gets in a game, and the game ends up to be a chaotic game, and you find out, though, well, maybe I made a mistake on this. But I'm not... Luke, this is way back when I came up, I had an opportunity to referee freshman basketball games.
Sure.
And they had good talent, young kids that couldn't play on the varsity playing freshman basketball. And I was going to the ACC freshman games, refereeing those, and the supervisor could ID me and say, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years at the freshman level, and then we'll move him into non-conference games. That was an easy road, even though at the time I was doing NAIA games and small college games. But for a supervisor to see me, I was in an ideal position because I was doing freshman games. That doesn't that's not the case now. But I brought guys in and had some success, and every guy that was recommended to me from a Division I supervisor usually panned out. They wouldn't recommend them unless they were pretty good.
What can an official in that position do to improve his chances of getting recommended? I mean, what is there you can do at that D2, D3 level?
He needs to have some success. If a guy came to me and says, John, I just refereed the Division II tournament, NCAA tournament, the last 2 or 3 years, and I've advanced to the round of eight or to the semifinals, and I could send you some game tape in the off season. I can send you some game tape of that Division II championship or semi championship or whatever. I would take my time and look at that. And if he's got a pretty good resume, then I'm going to maybe say that your next step is I got a camp and I want my staff to put eyes on you.
Okay.
Okay. If Mike Eaves and Jamie Lucky and those guys say, hey, you know, he's pretty doggone good and he's already referee up at the high level of Division II, we can use this guy possibly.
Is there an issue? This is one of the things that struck me watching this process. These camps, to clear the bar in a camp, no matter how good you are technically, if you don't have the right, you know, you're out of shape, you don't have the right authority with your mechanics, all these cosmetic things, you have to clear this cosmetic bar just to be considered, which is fine because... But are you losing, and then you get these guys into a position where you can look at them, break down the video, see how they are technically. Are you losing guys who are really good technically but don't have the look?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there was a time that the NBA felt like they could take a guy that looks the part, passes the eye test, is very athletic, and we will make him a referee. Okay? And then you have guys that are just the other end of that. And I'm not going to bring up any names, but there's one or two that I could tell you that are excellent referees. And they fight and they put themselves behind the eight ball because they don't look the part. And it's hard for them to sell their calls and their mechanics. Their judgment is off the chart. They're good. But... They struggle because they don't look the part. And the first thing I looked at camp was, is this guy athletic? Is he in shape? Did he come to camp in shape? Is he athletic? And, you know, is his mechanics good? None of those three are as important as his judgment.
Right.
But you can't always measure his judgment at a camp. You just can't do it. But if they're out of shape and they look frumpy and they
is frumpy a technical term?
It's my term. It's my term. But they could have great judgment. Some of them got great instincts. They just know what a foul is. But
yeah.
It's hard to make that sell that guy to the coaches.
One other piece of news today, the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame newest induction class announced, and Dee Kantner, the NBA official from Charlotte, inducted into the, or will be in this induction class. Selected for every NCAA tournament since 1992, worked 22 Final Fours, 8 national semifinals, 14 title games, 2 seasons in the WNBA, 3 world championships. That's a pretty good resume.
I can't imagine anybody even coming close to what I mean. We're talking about 22 Final Fours, 8 national semifinals, and 14 national championships. That's incredible. I mean, and I guess I know she's still, because I'm doing some work for the ACC on the women's side, and I'm going to see Dee at one of the I think she's got the Notre Dame NC State game. I'm not quite sure, but I think I'll see her. But she's still working, so maybe she's going to add to those Final Fours. And but yeah, that's quite amazing.
It's pretty impressive. In what you've been doing with the women's officials and evaluations and observing, do you see any who could potentially make the jump to the men's side?
Oh, I you know, there again, the game is a lot easier, in my opinion, to referee. But I saw several very, very good referees at NC State, and most of the games were very easy, and there's not a lot of low post physical play. There's a lot of perimeter shooting. But that's not taken away. That's their game, and they're refereeing them at a very high level. And there's two or three guys and women that I thought, wow, they're excellent. And when I came back and wrote my report, they got good grades because they were all in shape.
Mm-hmm.
They ran the floor. They had great mechanics. And their accuracy on play calling was good. No, they were a lot of really good referees I've seen.
Meant to note this during football season, but the CIAA had an all-female football crew work a game.
Ooh, did not know that.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I know that my son Connor pointed out that one of the female NFL referees is a female.
Yeah.
She had a playoff game.
Yeah, Sarah Thomas, I believe,
did she
had a playoff game. Yeah,
she
I think she's a line judge.
She's a line judge. She had a playoff game, you know. My son thinks she's really she wouldn't be in the NFL, but my Connor, he watches those officials, and he says she does a really good job. She's got, you know, one of the things, Luca, she fits the part, and she has an authoritarian kind of a makeup.
I mean, sure.
She's not backing down. You know,
no,
she's pretty doggone.
Well, I don't think you clear all those hurdles and make it to the NFL.
Right.
I mean, as a male or female, without having a certain authoritativeness to your personality, and she clearly has made it on merit and made working playoff games on merit, which is pretty impressive. Anything you want to add, John, before we wrap this one up?
No, I you know, going forward, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. There's so much talk and so much discussion about these officials and how poor a job they're doing in the NFL, and they got the biggest event probably coming up in the Super Bowl, probably same level as a World Series or the NBA playoffs, you know, and this Super Bowl, and I just hope they have an uneventful game and that they, you know, knock it dead. One of the things that's interesting, they have Gene Steratore on one of the networks. I think it might be ABC, and he's pretty accurate, but yesterday on that one that we talked about whether it touched his hand, Edelman. Gene was indecisive listening to him. He was himself, and he's looking at it just like everybody else. He was pretty indecisive. So these plays are really hard.
They're really hard. Well, that's it for episode 19. Our best wishes to Mike Eads for a quick recovery. Lord knows the ACC needs him for Charlotte and the big games down the stretch. We'll be back with our 20th episode at some point soon. Again, send your questions to me, ldecock@newsobserver.com or at Luke Decock on Twitter. We're happy to dig into them and take a look, get John's thoughts on it. Thanks again for listening, and we will be back soon.